My name's Don Newcomb. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, all right, Don.
Very happy to be here. Got in about 1:15 this morning. Lovely gift sitting on our table in the room. I have a 10, 8, and 6-year-old baby boys, and they wanted to get into my package. Don't touch it. That's daddy's. At 5:30 this morning, Donnie, my name, said, "Daddy, I can't sleep. I'm sick. I think I'm going to throw up. I'm hungry." Now, you can't put those together. We could, but he's not drinking. I said, "Your only problem is, Donnie, you looked out that window of ours that looks into that swimming pool, and you want daylight to get here, and you're just going to do it the hard way." I said, "Come on." I was a little irritated. I can't treat him badly because I have to make these amends, and I tell you, I hate apologizing. In the old days, it was easy. You just whoop him and walk out the door. But now you got to sit and say, "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say that. I don't do anything." And so I took him into the room and opened up your gift to me and dug out a banana. And he proceeded to eat that banana and tell me all about that swimming pool. And I finally told him, I said, "You know, Daddy's only had a couple hours sleep, and I really need to get a little bit of sleep, and I can't go to sleep unless you curl up in my back." "Oh, okay, Daddy." And we went in, and he snuggled up to my back, and it's really a true story, because in our home we all sleep. It's a family bed. We all sleep in the same bed. And he snuggled up to my back, and I went out like a light. When I woke up with the alarm at 7, I looked over there, and he was sound asleep. So everything you've ever taught me has a use today. I'm glad to hear this is a theme of being in service or of service. I really don't give a damn, because when you give me a theme, you've lost me. It's like, "Oh, you want me to think intelligently? I don't have an education." Well, state of California, thank you very much. But I've been in service because of one main thing. When I first got new, I was surrendered enough to let someone tell me what to do, and I was afraid to not do it. Now, I don't understand why I was afraid to not do it. I spent 21 out of 26 years in prisons. I wasn't afraid to arm rob, and I was afraid of burglary because I'm scared of the dark, and I didn't know it till after the fact. But I walked into an area of people that just, they had a bad habit of just telling you what to do, and it was like you didn't have any choice. And I really thought I didn't have any choice. And I'm very fortunate today to think that I didn't have any choice. The odd thing is, today, with 30 years and a couple of months of sobriety, I still haven't got any choice. That's why I'm here. I didn't say, "Oh, what is my purpose?" I did that last night. "What do you want me to do, Lord?" I really didn't give a damn what Lord wanted me to do in 1970. Everybody said you had to have a spiritual experience, and I'd already had a number of them. They're called riots, you know, prison riots. They'll give you, I'll make you spiritual in a minute. You make that right turn and get in that cell just before the guy that got killed, and you think, "Phew, God, thank you. Whew, that's spiritual." Born and raised in Bakersfield. I like to say that's a good reason to start drinking. I'm Jack Daniels from Canadian Club and vodka, Johnson & Johnson, Blue Cross and Menin's if necessary. I've had long periods of not being able to drink the way I was accustomed to. And it wasn't periodic, it was just I was in prison. I'm a bad thief. I'd like you to think I was a good thief. I'm a bad thief. I'm an armed robber in a hometown with no mask. Bakersfield's not a big town. And I'd lay there in that cell. I remember that first time. I laid there in that cell and I thought, "Who in the hell told on me?" Somebody told me. But when I drink, I drink. I drink. That's the purpose of drinking, is to drink. I don't sit there and say, "Oh, is it morning?" Half the time, I don't know anyway. In Bakersfield, when you're a kid, or at least when I was a kid, you could tell morning by what side the cotton fields was shined up on. You know, if the sun is shining in on one side, you know, "Oh, well, But after a while, if you drink properly, you don't know east and west anyway. So it is no longer important. And wake up in a cotton field in somebody else's car. Y'all furnished me some nice automobiles, and I thank you for that. And hanging out the door, been laying in that dirt. You know, that cotton dirt's always kind of powdery. And you're laying there, and you've been puking, and it's stuck to your face. And you crawl up out of the damn sun and look at it. Oh, yeah, now I remember. I never thought about it. Why not? Why not? Everybody I know drinks that way. It wasn't a matter of, I shouldn't drink like that. I didn't have a job to go to. I never bothered with work. I always felt kind of ignorant. And if I try to work, it's confirmed that I'm ignorant. I don't do it well. And I like to party. I get locked up when I'm 9 years old and spend 3 years in institutions. And so I spend the next 20-some years in and out of prisons. Anybody can do that. It's real easy. There's a whole bunch of people doing it all the time. I never liked prison. It's just it was easier. I found it a lot easier. I didn't care. That's the price. Until they stop me, I got a little fun I'm going to have. And then I have a tab to pick up. And that tab is maybe 2 years, maybe 7 years, maybe three. Doesn't matter. But when that's done, when I come out, I ain't never coming back again. And I remember my last parole hearing, next to last. I'd had 7 years and 3 months. I had about, that I served, I had about 6.5 of it in. And the parole board, the man sitting there, asked me what it was I could tell him. It would allow him to believe that I might be able to live on the outside. And I looked at him and he says, what can you tell us to let us believe we can let you out of here? And I looked at him and I said, when you're ready to let me out of here, you will. Thank you very much. And I got up and walked out of the parole hearing. You got about 2.5 to 3 minutes to present yourself and try to not have to wait another year. I didn't care anymore. I really just didn't care anymore. I didn't have visitors. They'd long since got tired. Brother and sister, they hadn't been around. I don't think my brother's been in a prison yard maybe 3 times. He just didn't believe in visiting. And Alcoholics Anonymous in prison was because 1957, I'm a young, healthy man. I hadn't had my 21st birthday. They got some women coming in the front gate. I like women. I've always been fond of them. I don't like men. I had to make that major decision as a young child. And I looked over there, and here's some people walking through there. It's Soledad. The wind blows one direction every afternoon. You can smell the perfume from the gate. I said, damn, what is going on there? And they said, that's an AA meeting. I said, you just go over there and tell them you're an alcoholic. Well, hell, I've been an armed robber and a few other things you didn't know about. Being an alcoholic ain't no big deal. And I rolled in there because I wanted to see some legs with no hair on them, and I wanted to smell some perfume. Now, if that isn't the best motive for coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know what it is. And it didn't take. It just didn't take. I had an attitude. It just didn't take. There wasn't anything you said from them podiums. You look good. You did have those shaved legs. They reinforced a memory I needed. But you just didn't take. And I'd go to those meetings because when I'd get there, I'm a photographer in prison, and I used to get pictures when you'd come up and entertain the convicts. And you'd have little banquets for them. And I'd get you all photographs. And I'd get a few photographs I wasn't supposed to get. You know, I'm good with a camera. And thank you very much. There's some other evil people in this room. And then I'd sell those photographs. And that was my income. And I'd listen to you. And I'd think, if I ever get that weak, I'd just quit. I'd hold court in the street. I watched a guy who had been sober a short period of time, but when I knew him back in the early 50s, he was a hard convict. I mean, in order to be a real good convict, you have to really work hard at being bad. And to be successful at being bad, you can't be good. There's nothing confusing about that. That's just the lifestyle. You've got to be able to not tell anybody anything. You've got to be able to watch whoever dead in front of you and walk past them as though you didn't see them. And you got to hear all this stuff, and you got all these things. You got to jump in five people you don't want. It's just all these rules, and you can't never tell nobody nothing. And Alcoholics Anonymous seems to criminate around telling everything. You ought to get up here and tell stories of weakness that I just would just make me sick. My God, I'd be embarrassed by some woman talking about failing as a hooker. How damn hard of a job is that, for crying out loud? And she'd talk about how she'd go out on the weekends and supplement her income. And I'd think, you know, her old man ought to hear this story, because he'd probably kill her. And if he didn't want to do it, I'd do it for free, because I can't stand the disloyalty of a dishonest woman. You can't trust them anyway. So I wanted you to know that, so that these are the things I brought into Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember one year sitting up in Tehachapi finishing off what was to be my last sentence, I hope. Big ugly man come up. He was coming up kind of regularly. Ex-football player. They talk, I'm not a football person. I know the positions to a point. I question the sanity of any man who wants to get into a crowd of 300-pound men and get squished. And then I found out he was a center. Well, you wouldn't bend over in front of that many big men. Where I come from, that's questionable. You're not. The helmet should have been on a little bit longer. I'm sorry, Sally. I hate to do this. And they said he played for the 49ers and drank his way to the Canadian League and ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous getting help. And that day at that prison, he stood up there, and he was very sad when he got there. Well, I don't understand any of your emotions. I'm not interested in them. In the first place, you've got to be interested in them, and I'm not. You always had those questions. Hi, how are you? And I could never answer you how I was. I had no idea how I am. I look around the room and tell you how I've been. If I'm married, it's easy to identify a bad night. And he stood up there and he began to talk about how important Alcoholics Anonymous was to him. I couldn't give it to you verbatim because he sponsored me for 12 years and I still can't give you anything he told me, the exact quotation. That's not my job. It's not my job to find out how many of you come in the room here. It's none of my business. I'm impressed that people I don't know are sitting here, so I'm rather happy about this morning. And he started talking about, he was a little bit late to the commitment. I don't remember the exact thing, but he had to be over at the hospital because his daughter, who was this beautiful child, had been in a convertible car with some ugly human American and flipped the car over and tore half her face off. And she's laying near dead in this hospital, and he's sitting in this prison at this panel. And all I could think of is, whoa, you know, he didn't give a damn about her anyway. You know, how could he? What would he be doing up here? And I had no thought that was good about that whole thing, consciously. But I guess within a year, I walked out of that prison. Come down to Los Angeles. I usually give all my business to Bakersfield and Kern County. But I changed areas, and I come down to Los Angeles because he and a bunch of other people from this thing called Pacific Group were coming up there and doing panels. And one of them, a fellow by the name of Daryl F., had slipped me a phone number. You're not supposed to do that, but that's the only reason I would have took it, because he slipped it to me. It's like watermelon. You got a choice. You can eat this one, they're going to serve you, or you can go steal that one that's going to taste 10 times better. It's just the nature. And I come down into that meeting at Ohio Street, and he was there. Actually, the first meeting was out in Reseda at Shoot. They had this fella who ran around a pickup truck cleaning windows. His name was Marv. He put me in the back of the pickup truck. Didn't get to ride up front with the human beings. Whooped me around with bugs hitting me in the face. Told me how much I was going to love this meeting. Got to that meeting, Keith was there. Bunch of the same people that were coming up on those panels. And you walk into that door and the routine is so obvious it's just sickening. Hi, how are you? Fine. You know, I learned later that that's a newcomer's prayer. Fine. Just get the hell away from me. Don't ask me another question. Or they'd come up and the little weak-jawed men who had been laying around earning a living for 20 years. I'm in a penitentiary staying alive, baby. I've had to get up and kill in the morning some days that you're out there worrying about getting your lunch pail. And you want to walk up to me and say, how long you been sober? I have no answer. I don't even want to talk to you. Have you got a sponsor? And I usually would say, your mama. was with her last night working some steps. And then they would run to their sponsor, which is what I call the AA police, who would then run to their sponsor, who would then come around to my sponsor. At that time, I didn't have one, so I'm pretty clear. But they would come over, and they would address you in a voice louder than necessary and make you feel bad. And then I'm sitting there one night. I remember clearly with Rosie. We were sitting there, and I seen this young lady. When she walked in the room, our eyes met. And it was obvious that if there is a God, he wanted me to have this woman. He realized all those years I spent in the penitentiary, and this was going to be my reward. Rosie, not minding his own business, rolled over to me, and he said, "We don't do things that way here." And I looked at Rosie. He didn't look to be one of them sissy men. I couldn't quite understand why he had that attitude. And he went on to explain how you need to get this program and get a little foundation before you get involved. Emotionally involved, I think the word was. I'd been married once, had several girlfriends in between prison hitches, and I have never been accused of being emotionally involved. Never. I don't get emotionally involved. I take a hostage, it's mine, I own it. It will do what I say, and when it quits doing what I say, I whoop it real bad, and it disappears. Boy, I'll tell you, you're not a good date when you come into AA with that background. You're just not a good date. And everybody's whispering, he's sick. Well, of course you're sick. I mean, look at you, for Christ's sake. You think you're well? You're sitting in here listening to a man spend half his life in the penitentiary trying to give you information on how to live your life. There is something wrong with you, baby. You're not doing well. If you're new here today, you have made a gross mistake. Because anything I got to say up here is not going to keep you sober. The traditions were read. Chapter 5 was read. And you heard this young lady. And you, if you're new here today and you've never been to a meeting, I don't know if you got any. You will never drink comfortably again based on the information already given before I walk up here. I'm just going to give you my experience, I suppose. My interpretation, which varies considerably from time to time. I went out and got drunk two more times. Spent about 6 months out there, four of them trying to drink like a gentleman. Getting weekly visits from Marv, telling me don't let my pride get in my way if I find I have a problem with drinking. I didn't have a problem with drinking, but I was working at a sewing machine factory out in Gardena. And the problem I have is not drinking. The problem I have is those people. Because those people are causing me to have the thoughts I had when you got to control people. And I don't have a gun. I'm not allowed to carry one. I know that I'm going to get me a whole bunch of time if I carry one. And so it's in my mind that, okay, I'm going to leave these people alone. I'm going to do my best not tell Rosie. I don't have a problem with drinking. I have a problem with these people. And then one day, one of these people stood near me when a steam line over my head exploded. Now, I have this nervous condition. If you blow a whistle, I go face down, because that means you're getting ready to fire a shot off in the cell block. If you're screaming, I feel guilty. If you're a child screaming, I really feel guilty, because everything I control is always done with violence. I don't know any other way. I'm not a bad man. I don't want to mislead you. First time Keith hugged me, he hugged me. We're at a meeting and shoot. He hugged me. I'm intact, baby. I did 21 out of 26 standing as a man. I don't need some man hugging me. You ain't sneaking up on me in front of A&A. And I pointed out to him, you know, where I come from, people don't hug people. And he hugged me again. And he's big. He was even bigger. Now he's getting skinny. I might be able to take him about 2-3 more years. And all I had in my pocket was this tiny little knife, maybe an inch and a half for cleaning fingernails, they think. And I thought, if I take this out and stick him, as big as he is, it's just going to make him mad. And so he hugged me. An old-timer went by and stuck his hand out, and I ignored it. The old-timer's still in our group. I can't name him. I always want to. I still have a hard time liking him. I figure maybe in my 35th year I'll I'll do better. And I ignored his hand, and Keith scolded me, and he says, you know, and then I started using, I went into my higher education. I started using double syllable words. It started with M and C. And his lovely bride is standing over on the side, because at this meeting they had a little Al-Anon going on in one's back of the beer, and they had the A&A over here, and my language was not good. And he pointed that out to me, and he said, if I didn't shut up, he's going to take me out there. And what he pointed to was out in the dark, and we hadn't had a sponsorship thing going at this point, and I hadn't had a chance to let him know, I'm afraid of dark. And I don't want to, you're not going to take me out in the dark. And so I did the only thing I knew to do, I leaped at him. All 148 pounds of me. I leaped at him. And the next thing I know, I'm hanging off of this cliff called a stomach. And these arms, he's got arms on him as big as my waist, I think, and they're locked around me. And he's holding me, and I can't move. And I'm trying to get my fingers into my pocket. If I get that blade open, y'all are going to not like me. Him especially. And he got that face of his, and it's not the prettiest face in the world. Sally thinks so, but I question it. About that far from mine, he says, I love you a little, whatever it was. And that was not the information I needed when I could not move for the man that size. And then he proceeded to walk me out into the dark. And when we got out there, he set me down. And I don't know, for some reason, there was no fight. It was just gone. And he said it again. I love you. I want you to be sober. Whatever it was he said. Walked back into that room. I got drunk one more time. On the 13th of June, 1972, the woman that I had left with had about all she could handle. I had promised her one more time, tomorrow when I get up, you give me some of your money. She worked as a waitress, always had a little chump change. Love waitresses. If you're a newcomer, leave with a waitress. Catch one. They always got money. They're always good money. And I got her a car, and I'm going to go down, I'm going to get a job, and everything is going to be fine. As soon as I get a little work, we're going to leave California, because obvious, California is my biggest problem. No matter where I go in this state, they have been locking me up from 1944 to 1970, and they still had 3 more years on me to serve. Well, we'll fast forward that a little bit, because that's my privilege. I went out and drank, and I made that woman that promise, and every day I broke that promise, and I walked back into Ohio Street at coffee break. There's a man standing there by the name of Ramon Pena. He don't speak very good English. He's from El Paso, Texas. I knew him as a wino. They used to make me, I was an old timer, I had almost 9 months, and I had a car. And the guy that gave me the car, a couple of painters out in the valley, Rosie remembers, he gave me a car on the condition that I would give newcomers a ride. And I said, sure, not knowing how much newcomers impose upon you. Ramon Pena, as I gave him a ride, he had wine sores. They dropped him off in the old man Clancy's yard. He's laying there in the grass. He's like a big roll, just a big fat blub. The wine sores on him. You can smell him all the way across the yard, which is not easy in that yard because there's so many animals, so you can smell ahead of him. And he's looking around half dazed, and the old man told me to give him a ride and keep him at my apartment. I'm paying $17 a week for that apartment. It's flea-infested, but it's my apartment. And I really am not interested in having this Mexican come in and stay at my apartment. Number one, they tried to kill me in 1952 in state reform school, and they were quite sincere, so I had this little separation between us. It hadn't left simply because I walked into A&A. When I walked in, I moved my keys according to where they weren't. Homosexuals, I move my keys. I will not sit beside them because they're going to want to stand up and say the Lord's Prayer and hold my hand. And what if he squeezes my hand while he's holding it? I got to cut him. Now I'm going back to prison. All I wanted to do was come into a stinking AA meeting, have some kind of a peace of mind, and relax a moment. And I'm already put in a position to lose my life either physically or compliments of the state of California. But the minute I would move my keys, there would be one of those A&A police, and they would say, we don't do that here. It took me a long time to ask, well, how do you do it? It took me a long time. I fell in love, captured a newcomer, helped her. She got pregnant. Some newcomers just, you know, no class whatsoever. Just up and get pregnant on you, for crying out loud. Warden Hines, he never had any courses on family raising or how to prevent it. There's nothing in there to worry about. There's so much I'm censoring here. I'm supposed to behave myself, and I'm really trying to. So in 1972, when Ramon Pena met me at the door, coffee break, he said, hey, Vato, how you doing, man? And I looked into that one eye of his, and I said, fine. He said, bullshit. Damn. Mexican, he's turned on me already. I figured he's going to turn on me anyway. And then this old man, it seems like, but he leaned in and he told me how wonderful you people are. I questioned how wonderful you people are. I really questioned that. And at this point, I didn't seem to have a whole lot of choice. I had to run with who was there. They lined us up one day at Ohio Street. They're going to take us on a panel in Santa Barbara. And Rosie's got this big station wagon. He let me drive it once. And he's got this big station wagon. And we all meet at Ohio Street, and there's all collections of people there. There's the black man, and there's a Mexican man. There's a couple of you-don't-know-what-they-are men. And then there's some you don't even know if they're men. And we're all lined up in here, and he's setting out a system how to sit in his car. Like, I myself am probably 37 years old. I think I know how to sit in a car, even though I haven't been in one for quite a few years. And he pointed out to Earl Thomas, who was very, very black from Harlem, and he told Earl, you sit in the back there, and Nuke, you sit beside Earl. And he went on to point out these other seating arrangements when I tapped him and I said, Rosie, I need to speak to you a minute. And I proceeded to tell him that the blacks had tried to kill me and Tracy. If I isolated myself from all the people by religion or color or whatever, according to who was trying to kill me, I would be alone in this world. I'd have nobody to stand by. But I had this ability to pick out at the right time. And he heard my story, and he smiled patiently, and he said, the reason you're riding in the back with Earl is you haven't been sober long enough to ride in the front seat with me. I know rules. I know all about rules and regulations. I live by them all my life. And so began my relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous. Wonderful motives. Keith told me, I got him as a sponsor. He told me I had to be at 7 meetings a week. He ain't got a gun. He's not the warden. He ain't got a hold of my parole. I don't know why suddenly I am able to be surrendered enough to listen to someone else. I don't know why. I have no idea. I just did it. He told me I had to play softball on the weekend, had to go over to this old fool's house, clean up his dog poop all over this yard. I didn't do that in prison, baby. I'll tell you, I'd do 29 days in the hole before I'd do some menial job like that, for crying out loud. But I'm a hustler. I know how to scam, and so what I did is I became a pointer. That's really only good for the people who have been there. I point and you pick it up. Then you got a bag man, not the kind that you had in East Coast. These bag mans fill that bag with poop. Okay. I'm wonderful. I'm needy. I'm lonely. I caught. Went and told Keith after the fact. He told me, well, hell, maybe you both would need each other. I don't know. It might be good for each other. And 5 years later, and one child and my stepson, I realized why they didn't want me in that relationship. It was a hard 5 years. But in that 5 years, I was at 7 meetings a week. And I had commitments. And he told me to do that. And every damn time I'd get to the meeting, he would show up to just see if I was there. I knew that he never told me that, but every stinking meeting I went to, he was there. And so, this is what I do, you do it with me. Is that being of service? I have no idea. What it did is it made me be places I would not have been. It made me do things I would not have done. It made me start to like people I couldn't stand. And it made me quit looking around to see whose hand I was going to hold in the Lord's Prayer. I'm still racially prejudiced, not because of their color. I have no problem. I spend a lot of money every year trying to get a suntan. I have no problem with the color. I have a problem with the people because they caused me a great deal of terror at a time when I was vulnerable. And so I haven't trusted yet. But hell, everybody in that room had done that. There wasn't a woman in that room I'd trust. There wasn't none. I never met a good woman. I never met a woman you could trust. When you treat them the way I treat them, you can't trust them. They wanted me to learn the big book. Oh, he's got a brilliant way of working the big book. It's all physical. Doesn't require any thinking. Read this, you read it, you done it. Okay, next step. Read this, you read it, you done it. Okay, next step. Then we did it, and we got all done. And I found out football players are dirty old men. I'll tell you that right now. I don't mean to tell that on him, Sally, but I gave him up some secrets that, it turned out he handed a couple back at me. And then we got out of the car, and we went over, and he says, take all that paper and put it in that rock right there and let's burn it. And that was the best news I had, because in that paper were several convictions. Several convictions. So they put me in prison for an awful long time, and I was quite nervous. But for some reason, I had the willingness. I don't know what it was. I don't know where it came from. But again, it was what was instilled in me when I came back realizing, I don't know what else is going on, but drinking's got to be stopped. It just has to be stopped. And we proceeded to burn that paper. And the worst stench in the world began to come up from that smoke. It was, and I expected it. Because I had some real garbage on that paper. And it just stunk. It literally stunk. And I looked at him. I said, you smell that? He said, yeah, somebody's been peeing here. Sponsors know everything. Everything. If you hang around Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody's going to walk up and say, would you sponsor me? And it's always going to be the worst sucker, that the last one in the world you want to sponsor. And I'd lose them. They'd come in. They'd stay sober 2 weeks, tell everybody who their sponsor was, and then get drunk. And I mean, it makes you look bad when you're in a group where you wear babies like a badge. You know, how many babies you got? I got 15 this week. Next week you got one, 14 of them out there slipping. I'm a little exaggerated, but not entirely. And then I caught one that stayed sober, and all of a sudden I got to give him the big book. He made me read 3 pages every night. And so I told this guy, because sponsorship's just an opportunity to get even. I tell him, you got to read me 3 pages a night. If you want to read more, you can, but you must read 3. Now, what am I going to do? Go over to his house and look over? I never understood. I read those 3 every stinking night. Got to the 3rd step, talking about God. I don't do God. I know he's there. They tell me he's supposed to know everything. I'm hoping he's got a bad memory. That's the best I can come up with. And he's talking about this seemingly bad as well as the good is necessary for your growth. And I'm thinking, oh, God, if I ever get like that, I'll go back and run a meeting at Folsom. And I'd watch you, and I'd see you in them rooms. That daughter got well. She did just fine. I watched the relationship between them, and I realized that there's something special there, and I don't know what it is. I'd watch him go into that home. He got a nice home out there, wherever we were, Tarzana, I guess it was. A swimming pool, beautiful wife, children running around there. I think, God, how do you do that? I can't even touch my stepson. He wants to sit in my lap, and I can't hold him because men don't touch men. Boys don't touch boys. I got nailed when I was 7 years old, and I didn't lose the memory. And I come in here, that's one of my big secrets. And one day I told him, he noticed there was some discomfort, and I told him what it was. And he said, well, let me show you. He showed me how to hold my son. And the day came when my son had finished 4 years in the Navy on the USS Enterprise. And he's over 6 foot tall, and he weighs over 200 and some pounds. And I hadn't seen him in a year and a half. And when you haven't seen somebody you love severely, a lot of it is just instinctive and impulsive. And the door, there was a knock, and there stood Michael. And when I opened that door, he grabbed me, he picked me up, he gave me a kiss, said, I love you, Daddy. I kissed him back, and I said, I love you too, and Keith had taught me how to do that. Taught me how to kiss my son. Had to be taught how to kiss my son. I'm not well equipped for living on the outside. I'm in the yard keeping commitments. I have to do my job. Idiots like The AA police are saying we do 110%. I think 100 ought to be enough. We do 110. Keith is telling me, put a dollar in the basket, you'll get 10 back. Come on. And then I'd need some money, and I'd go ask him, when do you get this back? And he'd tell me, when you need it. And then I'd ask for something. He'd say, if you really need it, you don't have to ask for it. It'll come to you. Oh, now that really is a heartbreaker. That is a heartbreaker. Fancy, Keith went out of the area and he moved to another state and he gave me a number and I had the privilege to call him every day if I chose to, but I'm just not that kind of a person. Out of sight, I'm out of mind. I'm sorry to tell you that with all the people in my life today, when they're gone, I have to struggle to get the memory back. There are so many replacing it, instant, immediate. It's fine. Whatever it is, it's none of my business. I ended up getting Clancy for a sponsor. He sent me on a 12-step call. He sent Mar with us. He sent Charlie McCutcheon, who is really a very ill man. He has glandular problems. His eyes are that big around. He looks like he's been on Benzedrine for a month. And he's about ready to kill something. And Rosie is packing him around like he's a new pet. This is Charlie. I know that's Charlie. I don't let Charlie get anywhere around my hindsight. If he's out of my vision, I turn. I keep him there at all times. We went on this 12-step call. We walked into this house, and it was a fellow from Philadelphia. He was a cab driver in New York, which means he was small and big mouth. Just talked 100 miles an hour. Drunk. And he kept shooting his mouth. But in that room was this old woman, who was his wife, who looked so tired. And they went to this Catholic church with Clancy's wife. And that's the reason we were sent there. He doesn't usually ever send us to 12-step calls where somebody hasn't asked for help. And I remember seeing over, Rosie's over in front of Joe. Joe's not very big, but Rosie's a mountain. And Joe started to say something else, and he got that mouth working, and Rosie leaned over, and he said, Joe, if you don't shut up, I'm going to break your damn arm. I like that spiritual concept of 12-stepping. And I went into the kitchen where this young lady was standing. She was about 20 years old, 21, having her 21st birthday coming up. Her hair ran down to the back of her knees. Beautiful Irish features, just Welsh Irish, just a beautiful woman. Look, if Madonna would ever been put into a photograph, I would almost see my wife as having that face. Just a beautiful woman. And I'm standing there, and she's crying. She's facing the stove, and I'm telling some mumbling some crack about, you know, honey, I've done worse than this. I've done much worse than what he's doing. He's just a drunk. But I seen that hair, and I reached down at the very bottom, and I just touched it, and she jumped. Now, I don't know how much sensitivity you women have in your hair, but this is like 3 foot away, and she jumped. She's still jumping. If there's anything, you stupid convict. If there's anything really beautiful in my life, it's asleep up there. In that room that you're allowing us to share in like we were luxurious guests. She never went to Al-Anon, but I remember when I was cussing. I usually cuss when I can't hit no more. He told me I had to stop. Nancy told me I had to stop. He told her, at our wedding day, he told her, if he ever hits you, call me. And she said, why does he want me to call him? Because he's going to come over and kick my butt. And he can do it because, you know, if he doesn't, there's a whole line of his stupid babies. He's got 500 babies to cry. And we all wear these protective cloaks. He used to outrage him to think that we'd go to meetings to protect him. He told Marv and I and Keith, we followed him into a Hollywood church because he used to, they'd say bad things about him. I know you can't believe that about Grandpa, but they'd say bad things about him. And they'd rattle newspaper. Well, only one did that because Clancy pointed out that years earlier when he was drunk, he would go in, this guy would be the speaker, and he'd rattle newspapers, and the guy hadn't forgot, so he'd come back and got even. But we'd hit the doorway, and we'd block for him, and Keith, being the largest, would be front. Marv's right here, and I'm coming up behind because I'm fast and I'm low. And I can cut you quick. I really can. I have no problem with cutting you. It just doesn't bother me a bit. So we're ready, and this is my sponsor. And I'd have this stupid vision at that time. Well, he wasn't Keith, but I had this vision of somebody in the back of the room yelling that maybe Keith would be at the podium or Clancy, and they would yell,
I told you I'd get you
and come up with a gun to shoot him, and I throw myself in front of the bullet. That was the only sign I had that I might have a feeling of love for this human being. So this Catholic and I, after 7.5 years of being engaged with no bedroom privileges, which will make a lot of tension in a young man, and even at 40-some years of age, my head was still a young man. But I had messed up every marriage and every relationship I've ever been in by violence. My relationships are all violent. My children and the family that I had before sobriety were damaged badly from my violence. I don't care what it is. When I can't control it, I throw it. If I can't throw it, I hit it. And at one time, if I can't shut it up, I put a knife in it. And that's what I do. And you had to take this and rearrange it. Nobody run me off. They just said, we don't do that this way. Out to just destroy a human being. And I remember so clearly, Ramon told me, you know, Vato, you can kill that old man. That's old timer. You can kill him, all right. He said, but I tell you what, Vato, tomorrow you're going to have a bad day. Now I got a conscience. Now I got a conscience. Had to quit stealing in AA. This Catholic woman fooled around. We had 2 years before the first child came along. She says, I think I'd like to get pregnant now. Like clockwork. I don't know how they do that. We're not even making amends. It's just, okay, it's time. Oh, boy, I like this part. This is the part I like best. Wham, bam, bam, da, bam, bam. You know, here we are. All of a sudden, she's big. About 7 years earlier, she made it clear to me that whenever she had a child, just kidding. Who was it that didn't show up? You're going to hate him before this is over. She had mentioned that she would like me to be there when she has a baby, and I am not interested in that information. That's information I don't need. Woman's business. Y'all just have them babies, do what you're supposed to do, but don't let me see all this crap. But I made a mistake of sponsoring a fellow named Al, who was married to a woman named Sharon, who was very, very pregnant, and in St. John's Hospital, and I got the message that they were having the baby, and I am a loyal sponsor. And so I run over to the hospital to support my baby, Al. And when I walked in there, I'm the oldest thing on the nurse's floor, and they threw a gown on me, they threw a mask on me, and they thought I was a grandparent, and put me in there, and there's Sharon. There's Sharon, in all her glory. And I'm looking, I'm loyal, baby. I don't cheat, unless I'm drinking, I don't cheat on anybody. And I'm loyal, and I'm looking everywhere except at Sharon. And then I went over there, and she said, if you're going to be in here, you've got to do something. She's going to give me a commitment. And she's having this labor crap, and she's having a hard time with it. She said, when I have a labor pain, you shove on my back. But when I went to do my job, there's a little mirror over on the side, and I could see what was going on. And this head was coming out of there. And I thought, my God, ain't that something? You know, and I forgot to push, and she screamed at me, Newton, if you're going to be in here and do a job, do your job. I said, Jesus Christ, she's a newcomer to me. I'm an old-timer to her. I didn't know that 8 years later I'd be sitting in a hospital delivering my own child, at least watching my child be delivered. I didn't know that a year and a half later I'd deliver my son on the front seat of a station wagon on the way to the hospital because I told her she's in false labor. I gained so much information that I thought I was smart. And I didn't know that when we walked into the hospital, I knew one thing. On the third child, I was not going to tell her any of her business. Not going to do that. And that child was born 30 minutes after we walked in, and she talked about wanting 10 children. I work as a building engineer, and I've been working at it since 84, and I have been getting paid in the union since 86. You taught me how to work. You taught me what to do. I have no God. I am aware there is a God. I have no problem with that. When I walk in the room, I see the Ramon Peñas and the Marvars and the Keith C's. I see all these people, and I know where they came from, and I see how beautiful they are today, and I know there's a God in the room. But I can't have one, because I've done a couple of things at a very young age that I cannot ever get past, period, in my mind. 5 years ago, come October, I crawled underneath a car out in Valencia, California. I had it jacked up. I had no jack stands. I had the right front tire off. When I started to crawl out of that, my three children were in the backyard with this fellow John that I sponsored, with his four children, and I would prefer to tighten up those bolts than to go in that backyard and play with all those people. And as I tightened, I went to crawl out from under there, and that car, that jack collapsed, and the brake rotor buried itself in my forehead. I had been loving and kind to the men I sponsor, and to their wives, and to their children, for over 25 years at that time. I have changed greatly. And the man under that car wasn't some hard convict out of Folsom or any place out. It was a human being who just kept crying out with a voice I couldn't even get clear with, "Somebody help me, would you please help me?" And I couldn't even be heard. I think my wife said she heard mumbling sounds, didn't know what it was. And then I said, "God help me," and it just went quiet. It was so obvious the presence of God in my life underneath that car. I felt no pain, I had no fear. It was just a sweet moment. And my wife came out with her 136 pounds and picked that car up off my head. And they rebuilt this head with titanium. They rebuilt this eye socket. They told me I'd never work again. And I had no way to earn money, and I had no way to pay rent. And my home group gathered together, and my sponsor made an announcement. And I never seen another bill for the next 2 years, including all my rent, my DWP, and everything else. And it wasn't something I asked for. I didn't have to ask for it. It came when I needed it. And people were there to tell me, you know, the reason you're getting this is because you did it for 25 years. You put it in the pot for 25 years. You went to the Charlies, and you went to the other people when they were down and out. And when they asked, you gave. I had no idea. I come out of that with a God. That was my 25th year of sobriety. Took a lot of wrinkles out. I think they made me kind of pretty, to tell you the truth. Opened up the roof of my mouth, and it killed my sense of smell. I have three babies in that house, and two of them's in diapers. When you have taken a man's sense of smell away and he's got diapers to change, you've done him a great favor. But you know, after a little while, it doesn't take long to realize that a family of five, you have to work. I don't know how I can stop working. I hated work. And now I have to work. And so I proceeded to get myself physically stronger. And I went back on a job as a relief engineer, just token amount of hours a month, just barely holding my own. Could barely do the job, but they were kind enough to let me try and pay me full scale while I'm doing it. And I'm just about to nail the job, and I went in because I had a little blood coming out of my nose. And I went in, and the doctor said, "I want you to go over to this specialist because I did a blood test and your PSA is high." I don't know PSA, smell, whatever. So I went in there, and he sent me to this specialist. He ran some things up inside of me. When I got off that table, I stood there like a drunken whore, KY jelly running down my leg, and I looked at him, and I said, "You mean that's what I thought about all those years?" He said, "I beg your pardon." I said, "Oh, never mind." My mind has never left where I've been. When I got off that table, he told me I had cancer, 6 points in my prostate. I called my sponsor. Isn't that what you do? I called my sponsor. That's what he taught me to do. That's what his sponsor taught me to do, and that's what I do. And I said, "What do I do?" He says, "Have it cut out." I didn't say, "Well, Vance, did you have yours cut out?" There's some side effects with cutting out that little fella under there, you know. There's some things that'll make you have a bad moment. And I went back to the doctor and made arrangements, and we cut that out. About a year later, I'm laying in my arms with my wife, and I'm kind of crying a little bit about, I didn't really want to give up some of this. I really wasn't ready to quit. I wanted another child. I wanted a little girl. I wanted to have a chance to raise that one that I didn't raise the first time. God bless my little Tanya. But I didn't get the chance to raise her. She left at 9 hating me. Totally verbalized it. Sober. I and she. And I laid in my wife's arms and I said, "What are we going to do?" They said, "Maybe a couple of years you might have this... What are we going to do? I'd better be alive. I want to be with my children. We homeschool. Would you believe that? I'm one of the teachers. I want to be alive. I want to live with my children. I want to see them grow. So, okay, we'll get rid of that. I'll learn to live with that." And she said, "Honey, God gave you that power to begin with. If he wants you to have it back, he'll give it back to you." And I felt such a sense of relief because I knew that she had already come to grips with it. I was more concerned that this woman of 21 years younger than myself was going to just disappear from my life. And I love this woman more than anything in the world. I don't cheat on my wife because it'll give me a bad day. And I've done that so long that I don't cheat on my wife because it's too selfish and self-centered, and it's the wrong thing to do. Same reason I don't steal. It's selfish and self-centered, and it's the wrong thing to do. But I did walk in the room a little bit later, and I looked at her, and I said, "Would you ask him to hurry?" So I got a job. Here I am. I'm back working. I'm out in Pasadena. I got a pain in my belly. I go to a doctor because you can train me to do that. And this doctor takes out a gallbladder that's totally gangrene. And now I can't work again. And they started sending me on these little jobs after I physically could get to them. And I did what you taught me to do everywhere I've ever been, to 110%, 110%. I walked around that building down at 1901 Avenue of the Star, and that guy told me, he said, "Don't slow down, you don't have, you're just here as relief." And I'm thinking, oh, another one, it's another rejection. And I said, "Can I give him my resume?" And I gave him my resume, he ho-hummed it and walked out of the room. And I kept working 110%, and I went around there and I looked for work to do, and there wasn't any. And one day he called me in and he says, "You notice I quit doing resumes?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I've decided I'm going to keep you." That was the 18th of March. I'm now self-supporting through my own contributions. We work full-time. Now it's going to take a while. It's going to take a while to get out of the hole that was cut 4 years ago. And that daughter of mine, I did something I made every baby I sponsored do. I got her email address in Rochester, New York. And I wrote her a little email and I said, "If I've ever done anything to harm you, I want to tell you that I love you and I'm sorry." And I got my little girl. And she came back running to Daddy's arms. She wanted that man so bad. So I got that little girl I wanted so bad. And I got this potential running around. And I got this beautiful three boys. When you see my boys out here, I wish you to say hello to them because they're going to talk your ear off. They are beautiful. And talking children are not abused children. And I love my boys, and I kiss my boys every day. I kiss them on their face, and I tell them I love them because he taught me how to love them. He had a terrible thing this past year and lost his son. But thank God he got to have some of that time with him. It's so precious to it. You're sitting in this room now. I ain't going to say nothing that's important, but I want you to hear this. You're sitting in this room now beside somebody you may know or may not know. And you cannot tell me that you'll get up tomorrow morning. You cannot tell me that you're going to wake up tomorrow morning. You can't do that. I woke up and was near dead by 3 in the afternoon. You can't tell me that. I cannot afford to have a rift between my wife and I. I must let her know that I'm sorry for what I said or that I love her as much as I love her. I must let her know that today, not tomorrow. I must tell those children. I sometimes scare my children. I raise my voice. I got a strong voice. I raise my voice. They just stand there almost frozen. I've not hit them in years. I don't spank them. Spanking feels too good to me. I can't do it. But when I raise my voice, they obey. And then I do something that you showed me out of the big book. He showed it to me. If you're going to take a moment to criticize, take a moment to praise. And whenever I scold my boys about, before that period of time passes, I go back and tell them how well they're doing in another area. I'm sorry I took so much extra time. I love you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Donald.